all in a five-year period. Investors were then able to buy a house worth $150,000 for $100,000 because no one else was buying. Getting ready for the next crash. A successful long-term investor is prepared to prosper in any market. Here are ways you can prepare. 1. Know your market prices and rents. In a rapidly changing market, it's challenging to keep up with changes in prices and rents. An active landlord who is constantly buying and renting property has the best information. Lenders and appraisers will be dealing with outdated information. What happened last year or last month is not an accurate indicator of today's market. This time lag between actual values and last month's values gives the active investor an advantage over those who rely on historical statistics. Because appraisers are always relying on yesterday's sales, their appraisals will be high or low depending on the direction of the market. 2. Have some cash in the bank, or know where and how to get it. A successful investor has the benefit of large cash flows and the luxury of keeping enough cash on hand to take advantage of downturns in the market. However, a new investor is likely to be fully invested with little cash on hand. An investor is more at risk in his or her early years because he or she has little in cash reserves. There are alternatives to having cash in the bank. One is a line of credit that you could draw on if you needed it to survive or to buy a bargain. A line of credit might be secured by your home. If you do that, know that you are risking your home to buy an investment. An unsecured line of credit can be available from a bank or credit union. These typically need to be repaid within a short time and most require monthly payments. A second source is an investor with cash that would fund your purchase if you found a great deal but were short on cash. More on this in Chapter 9. A third source of cash would be equity in a property that you could borrow against or sell to get some cash to buy bargains. And the fourth source of cash is the knowledge of how to buy without banks. You will learn more about this in Chapter 8. 3. Rent to tenants with diversified employment. If all of your tenants are in the building business, they may all leave when the building stops. Tenants with multiple sources of income are more likely to survive a bad recession. 4. Embrace change. Successful long-term investors embrace change. They anticipate it, look forward to it, and don't panic when it occurs. As mentioned in my book, Building Wealth in a Changing Market, McGraw-Hill, 2007, successful investors not only adapt to change, they exploit it. While the majority sit on the sidelines wringing their hands, successful investors are looking for and buying opportunities created by the change. While it's impossible to predict the future or when your market will change, the first person who recognizes the change will be the one who has the best chance of surviving and profiting. Strategies for surviving market crashes. 1. Own something free and clear. You may not own a house free and clear when you are starting, but you might own your car, your tools, or maybe a part interest in a property. A great goal is to get your home paid for. 2. Use options to buy in a hot market. An option to purchase real estate is a contract that gives the buyer the right, but not the obligation to buy. If prices drop, then the buyer can choose not to close. 3. Avoid personal liability on dangerous debt. Dangerous debt is described in Chapter 7 as debt that you cannot repay from the cash flow on the property that is security. If you lose this property in foreclosure, then your other assets could be at risk. 4. Limit your losses. If you own a losing property, the faster you sell it, the less you will lose. A property that costs you a lot to own each month and that is declining in value can consume all of your money and a lot of your time. Dump it fast, and you might have a chance to make your money back by buying a bargain. 5. Renegotiate debt that you cannot pay. A lender that is not getting paid in a declining market does not want to repossess property. They, too, want to limit their losses and will renegotiate the terms of debt that you owe them to avoid a foreclosure or possible bankruptcy. Ask them to forgive late fees, reduce your payments, and even reduce your principal balance. The cause and effect of cycles. Rent and price cycles. House prices and rents do not typically rise or fall in tandem. When rents are cheap, renters are happy to stay renters. When house prices start rising, more people become interested in buying. More buyers can mean fewer tenants and result in stable or even dropping rents. Be aware of the relationship between rents and prices in your town. When rents are cheap relative to prices, then either the rents will increase or the selling prices will fall. Conversely, when rents are high compared to selling prices, more will want to buy and selling prices are likely to rise. Credit cycles. When loans for acquiring houses are easily available, prices move up sharply as more buyers compete for a limited supply of houses. After a recession, bankers are slow to re-enter the market. They want to make sure of the trend before lending. Recessions are often followed by legislation designed to prevent the next recession. These new laws also slow a recovery. Construction cycles. When builders can build and sell at a profit, more will enter the market until the market becomes overbuilt. National builders are self-financed through the sale of their company's stock, so they are not as limited by the availability of credit. Smaller home builders rely on banks for construction loans. These loans are typically 1 year in length. When they can't sell, they are under pressure from the bank to liquidate and pay off the loan. You can buy houses at a bargain price in a down market by just paying off the construction loan. Neighborhood cycles. Neighborhood cycles are as important as broad economic cycles. A brand new neighborhood may look inviting, but it might not look this good again for 30 years. New houses are often bought by buyers at premium prices and with large loans. The next recession could cause many foreclosures as highly leveraged homeowners walk away from their mortgages. The result is that these homes are often bought by investors who will rent them. When renters displace owner-occupants in a neighborhood, the quality of the neighborhood and the price of the house declines. Older neighborhoods where renters are being displaced by owner-occupants who buy and fix up a well-located but older home will increase in value. Look for this trend and houses that you can rent for a few years while the neighborhood improves. They often are a better investment than new neighborhoods. These older neighborhoods often have many free and clear houses, so there will be fewer foreclosures and short sales during a crash. This gives these neighborhoods more price stability. House cycles. Houses, too, have cycles, from new to dated, but still functional, to too old to fix. Most houses I buy are in the middle category and can be kept functional for decades with routine maintenance. Although you can fix any house, it is not economically feasible to bring back most old houses. At some point, it makes more sense to tear them down and build new. Changing your strategy as markets change. As markets change, you can buy more property when prices are favorable and sell your weaker properties when prices are higher and it's easy to sell. It's a mistake to try to sell all of your properties at what you think is the top of the market and then try to buy back in at the bottom. If you have acquired easy-to-manage houses in neighborhoods with potential, financed so that you have cash flow, don't sell them just because they go up in price. These are the investments that will produce profit for you every day that you own them. In addition, good tenants are assets. If you sell and then buy back in a few years, you will have to do a lot of work to replace them. What part of the cycle is your market today? You can't know the future, but you can be aware of your market direction today. Are your prices rising or falling? Is it easy or hard to find good tenants? Can you borrow on terms that allow you to make a profit? When it's easy to borrow, it's typically easy to sell and harder to rent. When it's hard to borrow, you get your best buys, and often the rental market is stronger. There is always opportunity, whatever your market is doing. You can find a great buy in any market if you look hard enough and look in the right places. I prove this when I teach my class on acquiring and managing houses once a year in my hometown. In the class, students go into neighborhoods and find a great opportunity, often in just a couple of hours. Some years, they find a dozen opportunities in a short time. Other years, they have to work harder to find an opportunity, but they keep looking until they do. If you are interested in learning more about my classes, you can see my class schedule at www.johnschaub.com. There are a lot of houses, most owned by owner-occupants, and a lot of them sell every year. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, there are more than 82 million detached, owner-occupied, single-family houses in the United States. There are approximately 115 million total occupied, owned, and rented housing units in the United States, and more than 60% of houses are owner-occupied. Just under 5 million, 4,940,000, existing homes were sold according to data from the National Association of Realtors. Another 437,000 newly constructed homes were sold in 2014, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Over the long term, houses have a history of appreciating prices. See Figure 3.1 in the accompanying PDF. Chapter 4. Finding Opportunities That Others Miss. Now that you know the price range and size of the house you want to buy, you can begin looking for opportunities. This can be overwhelming because there are often many properties for sale. Focusing on certain neighborhoods and specific types of properties in those neighborhoods will help you to identify the houses you want to research and then to make an offer. Sources of opportunities. A great thing about buying houses for investments is that there is an unlimited supply of opportunity. Every day new houses come on the market. Every day people's lives change unexpectedly and they decide to sell their house. Every day brings new opportunities. One of my teachers, Warren Harding, encouraged me to look for good deals close to where I lived and worked. He advised me to never drive down the same street twice. Instead, drive down different streets in different neighborhoods and you will constantly see new opportunities. Real estate opportunities are everywhere, yet some investors drive for hours or even go to other states trying to find greener grass. They drive past or fly over thousands of opportunities near where they live. Out-of-town management can be an expensive adventure. I know firsthand. I've owned investment properties in 10 states. Today, I only own property in the town where I live. Owning property close to you allows you to stay on top of the management or to manage it yourself. Even more important, you know your market and can buy when there are buying opportunities and sell when the market is hot. Most buyers look at properties listed for sale. The best opportunities are not on the market for sale. They are not listed, and there is no sign in the front yard. When you can identify a house that an owner wants to sell and that is not listed, you have no competition from other buyers. Here are my top sources of opportunities for investment homes. 1. Empty houses. Not all empty houses are opportunities, but most opportunities are empty houses. An empty house is costing somebody money every day. In addition, it is a source of worry and work for someone. Look for empty houses and contact the owners. If the house is empty, knock on the neighbor's door and ask if he knows where the owner has moved. If that fails, look up the neighbor's phone number and call him. Neighbors typically don't like an empty house next door, especially if it is not being maintained. Neighbors can be a valuable source of information. The owner may be a lender who has foreclosed or an heir who has inherited the property. 2. Houses that need work, especially in nicer neighborhoods. Houses in disrepair stand out, especially on a good street. Some people are just poor housekeepers, but more often they are short of money to repair the house. Occasionally, the house is rented to a tenant who is not maintaining it. All these situations signal potential profit. 3. Out-of-town owners. While you cannot see this from the street, you often can find an owner's name and address in the public records. When you spot an empty house or one in disrepair, look up the owner. This can often be done on the internet. If not, go to your county courthouse and ask for help in looking up a property's owner. While you are there, ask how to find out if there are any mortgages or liens against the property and read those. You can learn what the current owner paid and what he or she owes. 4. Landlords who are not maintaining their property. When you see an occupied house in disrepair, knock on the door and ask if it is for sale. If it is rented, the tenant typically will tell you and may even give you the landlord's name and phone number. If the landlord is out of town, he may be more than willing to sell. You can tell the tenants that if you buy it, you would be willing to fix it up and maybe rent to them. Sometimes the tenant is the problem, and sometimes the problem is the owner. Some houses are occupied but not rented. Either the tenants have quit paying rent and the landlord has done nothing to correct the problem, or sometimes a relative or friend has moved into a house to house-sit or take care of it until it sells. If the tenant or house-sitter is not a good house and yard keeper, it detracts from the house and makes it harder to sell. 5. For sale by owners, FSBOs. Many owners try to sell their property without the help of a broker. Some of these owners do not have enough equity to pay a broker, and you can buy their house simply by taking over their payments. Other sellers may own their property free and clear and be willing to finance the purchase. Still others have had bad experiences with brokers and may be anxious to get rid of a house that is a problem to them. Their problem may be your opportunity. Before you go to see their house, research what they paid for it and what they might owe in the public records. Ask them the questions listed on pages 37 through 39. Don't waste your time and energy going to see a house until you are sure that it is an opportunity that you want to buy. 6. Real estate agents. Although some of my best buys have been from agents, they are a seasonal source of deals. When the market is hot, they don't need buyers, so you won't get many calls. When the market cools off, they have more sellers than buyers, and they will call you. Ask a lot of questions when they call to qualify the house. They will try to sell you anything they have listed. Don't waste your time unless you smell opportunity. 7. Lenders. Like agents, lenders are a seasonal source of good buys. When the economy softens and lenders foreclose on many loans, they need buyers and will be cooperative in selling you properties at wholesale prices. When the market is hot, they have few foreclosures and don't need buyers. 8. Letters to owners who may need to sell. Sending out letters and postcards to sellers who may have a financial problem can be very productive. However, this process costs money and requires a good system so that you follow up on leads aggressively. I have walked into a house of a seller in foreclosure and seen a pile of letters from buyers who have written trying to buy the house. I bought the house because I knocked on the owner's door and talked with her. If you could send out 1,000 letters at a cost of $1 each and get one good lead and buy one good deal, would the letter be a good investment? Of course, but it takes effort to write a good letter and send it to the owners in trouble to the right addresses. You don't buy houses with letters. You generate leads. 9. Foreclosures. Many good buys are made because the seller has a financial problem, so a house in foreclosure seems like an obvious opportunity for an investor. However, only a few houses in foreclosure are in the price range and neighborhoods where you want to buy. A high percentage of foreclosures have loans far greater than their value. Look for foreclosure opportunities in the neighborhoods where you want to buy and follow up by knocking on the door. The best deals will not have a sign in the front yard or an ad in the newspaper. The way you will find them is to walk through neighborhoods and knock on doors. Asking questions to know what the other party wants. If you are calling on an ad in the paper or someone has called you, before you hop in your car to go see the house, ask the person a few questions. The answers to these questions will help you to decide which houses are potential deals and which sellers you want to meet. If you are walking through a neighborhood and find a house that looks like an opportunity, you want to ask the owner these same questions. In a normal market, 90% of the houses for sale are not opportunities. You are trying to identify that one seller in 10 who might have a reason to make you a good deal. After you find the right seller, you want to determine whether this house has the potential of making you money. Not all houses are opportunities. Asking the right questions gives you clues about how anxious the seller is to sell the house, and then the information will help you to make an offer that the seller can accept. It will increase your chance of buying a house at a good price. Ask these questions to determine a seller's motivation to make you a good deal. The first questions will be easy for the seller to answer. As you ask the harder questions, you are both gathering information and testing the seller's eagerness to sell. If the seller keeps answering questions, eventually the information you receive is not really in the seller's best interest to share with the potential buyer. Keep in mind that the seller is answering the questions to keep you interested in the house because he or she really wants to sell it. As you ask these normal questions, take notes because you will learn a lot. Number a sheet of paper or take notes on your computer and record the answers to the following questions. 1. Are you the owner? Many times a neighbor or relative will answer the phone for an out-of-town owner. If so, ask for the owner's cell phone number and call him or her directly. 2. Where is the house? Only pursue houses in neighborhoods where you want to own property. Write down the address and phone number. 3. How large is the house? Look for houses large enough to accommodate a family. 4. How old is the house? Older houses may be in great neighborhoods, but be aware of fragile and high-maintenance houses. 5. How large is the lot? Look for lots of normal size and regular shape with adequate front and back yards. 6. Does the house need any work? All houses need some work. Look for an honest answer. 7. What school districts is the house in? Know which schools are the best and worst in your town. Buy in the best districts that you can afford. 8. What are the neighbors like? Are there more tenants or owners on the street? 9. How long have you owned the house? Long-term owners often have larger profits and are easier to negotiate with. 10. Have you made any additions or remodeled? Not all additions or remodeling projects add value to a house, but new plumbing, electrical service, roofs, kitchens, and bathrooms are big pluses. 11. Is the house listed with a realtor? If so, when does the listing expire? 12. Do you have a current appraisal? If yes, ask how much it appraised for. These are warm-up questions. They let the seller know that you are interested and give you some basic information. If at this point you are interested in the house, move on to the following more probing questions. The questions that follow are ones that you should give the owner plenty of time to answer. 1. It sounds like a great house, so why are you selling? Listen. 2. Can your existing loan be assumed? The owner may not know, but most loans can be assumed with the lender's permission. 3. What is the balance on your loan now? This will tell you how much equity the owner has. 4. Are your payments current? Surprising enough, most owners will tell you. 5. What will you do if you don't sell? Is the owner moving anyway? When? The day before they move, most owners are really ready to make a deal. 6. How long has your house been on the market? This time. Most people answer 2 weeks, but it's the third time they have tried to sell. 7. How much did you pay for the house? If the owner balks at this question, tell him or her that you want to buy in a neighborhood that is appreciating. Ask if the house has appreciated since he or she bought it. In addition, you can point out that you can learn this information in the public records and would appreciate his or her time-saving assistance. 8. If you don't sell the house, would you consider renting it? If the owner answers yes to this question, you may be able to buy it from him or her with a small down payment. The owner won't get much down when he or she rents it. With hundreds of possible sellers to buy from, you need to learn how to use your time wisely. And asking questions over the phone is an efficient use of your time. You will be surprised by how much sellers will tell you. After you talk to a seller, rank both his or her motivation and the potential profitability of the house on a scale of 1 to 10. A partial list of motivations appears on page 40. You will hear many other answers and can fit them into this list. Use these scales to compare two or more houses directly and decide which one to pursue first. Once you find a seller with a high motivation who owns a house that is desirable, stop looking and go buy the house. Look for a seller who is trying hard to sell you his house. Every seller and every situation are different. You want to buy from a seller who needs to sell and who is trying hard to sell you his house, as opposed to someone who is playing hard to get. If you find yourself trying to convince the person to sell to you, the seller is not as motivated as you are. Look for a cooperative attitude in a seller. A seller who avoids answering questions and won't make concessions is not ready to make you a good deal. Another test that you can give a seller is to ask her to come to you. Before I go see a house in my town, I ask the seller to come to my office for a meeting. If she won't come, she is showing me that she is not motivated enough for me to make her an offer. If she doesn't show up, at least I know I have not wasted a lot of time. Sellers will try to get you to come see them. As a test, you should offer to meet the seller. If you do not have an office, offer to meet in a safe place, perhaps a bank lobby, convenient to you, or a coffee shop. If the seller does come, you will have won the first negotiation and learned something about his motivation. Seller's motivation scale. 10 is the highest motivation. 1. The seller wants to buy a new house when she sells. 2. The seller's kids are starting school next year and the family wants to move to another school district. 3. The seller is expecting twins and needs a bigger house. 4. The seller's in-laws are moving in and the family needs a bigger house. 5. The seller has bought a new house and it closes in 2 weeks. 6. The seller has a new job in another town starting next week. 7. The seller's spouse has a new job in another town starting next week. 8. The seller is leaving town tomorrow and can't afford 2 payments. 9. The seller is months behind in his or her payments and the foreclosure sale is next week. 10. The foreclosure sale is tomorrow and the seller will pay you to buy their house and stop the foreclosure. Potential house profitability scale. 10 is the most desirable. 1. Older small house in poor repair, small lot, marginal neighborhood. 2. Older family size house, good repair, marginal neighborhood. 3. Small house, small lot, marginal neighborhood. 4. Newer family size house, average size lot, busy street. 5. Older family size house, good lot, average neighborhood. 6. Newer family size house, good lot, average neighborhood. 7. Newer family size house, good lot, great neighborhood. 8. Older small house, great lot, great neighborhood. 9. Newer small house, great lot, great neighborhood. 10. Newer family size house, great lot, great neighborhood. One seller of an empty house called me from his new location, a 3-hour drive away. He knew I bought houses and said that he wanted to sell me his house. I looked at the house and told him I was not interested in buying it because it would not make a good long-term investment. He said he wanted to sell it to me anyway and would drive over to meet me. He drove 3 hours and made me an offer I could not refuse. When sellers are ready to sell, they will send signals like driving 3 hours to sell their empty house. There is no set formula for making offers. There is no rule that you make an offer after a certain number of hours or questions. Every seller is different. always test the seller to see if he is ready to sell you the property. The way to test is to ask questions and see how the seller responds. You can ask very direct questions such as, "Are you ready to sell your house today?" or "Can you be out by this weekend?" These questions will also raise the seller's level of expectation. She will think that you are interested in buying and buying now. You are, of course, but only if you can make a good deal. If you ask those two questions and the seller answers yes to both, then the seller is ready for you to make an offer. Before you sit down with the seller to make an offer, write down your strategy. Use the worksheet shown in Figure 4.1 to gather current market information and to think through what you want to offer. Write down the most you are willing to pay for the house, the price you hope to buy it for, and the best price you can imagine buying it for. Write down the amount and terms of the financing you need to make the house a viable investment. It's important to write down these figures. When you are making the offer, the seller may be a better negotiator than you are, and will try to talk you into paying more for the property. You need a well-thought-out plan before you actually begin the exciting process of negotiation. Successful buyers prepare and have a game plan before they make an offer. They anticipate the seller's response and plan a counteroffer. Like a chess player, a good negotiator thinks a move or two ahead. Like chess, your opponent sometimes surprises you, and when that happens, you need to step back and rethink your plan. Figure 4.1, Buying Strategy Worksheet. House address, date, seller's names. Other houses sold in the area. Address, price, date. Address, price, date. Address, price, date. Other houses now on the market in the area. Address, price, date. Address, price, date. Address, price, date. The estimated gross monthly rent the house will produce. Estimated monthly expenses, taxes, insurance, maintenance. Net amount available for payments. Highest price that you are willing to pay. Your target price. The best price you can imagine. The first price you will offer. The largest down payment you can make. The first down payment you will offer. The amount of financing. The terms of the financing. Interest rate. Term, number of years. Payment amount. Your projected monthly cash flow. Personal property and other terms or conditions important to you in this purchase. Chapter 5. Knowing what a house is worth before you make an offer. When you are buying a high-dollar item such as a house, you need to know what it is worth to you before you make an offer. You cannot predict what the seller will take for the property. The amount that a property will sell for can change every day. It is the price that a real buyer and the seller can agree on that particular day. Since both the seller's and buyer's situations can change in a heartbeat, the price that a property will sell for is unpredictable. The property's value to you can be established. If you are trying to buy a property that produces a certain amount of cash flow or that has a good chance of appreciation in value because of its location, then you can put a price on the property that you would be willing to pay. By researching recent sales of other properties in the immediate neighborhood that are comparable in quality and condition, you can learn what the property would sell for at a retail price. The retail price is the price that the property will sell for, given enough time, which is a long time in many markets, and exposure to the market by someone who is able to negotiate a sale. It is generally the price a competent realtor will get for a seller given enough time. You have heard that real estate is illiquid. A more accurate statement is that it takes time to liquidate real estate at a retail price. At a wholesale price, real estate is liquid. I will buy a house and close on it in 1 or 2 days, giving the sellers cash for their equity at a wholesale price. This is about the same amount of time it would take the seller to sell a stock and get cash. what is the difference between retail and wholesale? It is different with different types of real estate, so let's focus on houses. If you are buying land or commercial property, it is much more difficult to determine what a property is really worth, and the difference between retail and wholesale can be much greater. Even with houses, the difference between retail and wholesale is different in different price ranges. The lowest price housing in a community generally will be in poor repair and in neighborhoods with little potential for appreciation. Lenders are not fond of making loans on such properties, and because of this, buyers are unable to obtain financing to buy these houses. This makes the lower price range less liquid. Although you can buy these houses at what looks like a bargain price, when you sell them, you may have to sell at a significant discount or finance the purchase for a buyer with poor credit. Some investors buy these low-priced houses because they can rent them for a high rent compared with the price they paid for the house. But these houses will require a lot of management, and the owners will not benefit from the appreciation they might receive with higher-priced houses. On the other end of the price range are the most expensive houses in your town. These are more illiquid and might sell for a 20, 30, or 40% discount because relatively few buyers want these houses. Anyone who can afford to buy a very expensive house has other alternatives. These buyers can choose to buy less expensive houses, so the most expensive houses in your market also sell at a larger than normal discount if the seller is forced to sell in a hurry. This is a real opportunity for a buyer, but you must be able to afford to own the house until you can sell it at a retail price, and that could be a long time. Houses in the middle ranges sell for closest to retail. This makes them more of a challenge to buy at wholesale prices, but it makes them safer investments in the long run. Since these houses frequently sell at retail prices, it is easier to determine their value. You can research recent sales through your public records, which can often be found online, or through the multiple listing service records that any realtor can provide for you. Because these houses are more liquid, you can safely pay closer to a retail price, knowing that if you need to sell, you can get your money back in a reasonable period of time. What is a wholesale price for an average house in a moderately priced neighborhood in your town? It depends on your market conditions. If there are a lot of willing buyers in your market and lenders are willing to finance them, then a discount of 10 to 20% off the retail price is wholesale. It allows you to buy the house, hold it for a while, and then resell it for a profit. There are holding costs to owning a house. An investor will rent a house as soon as possible to generate income to pay the cost of holding the house and will wait to resell until the house has appreciated. A speculator may buy a house and try to resell it immediately for a much smaller profit. Until she sells it, she must pay the holding costs, which are depleting her profits daily. Obviously, investing for the long run is a much more predictable way to make much more money with less risk. If you are new to a market, how do you know how much to offer when you are buying a house? You can pay for an appraisal before you make an offer, but that is expensive, time-consuming, and appraisers do get it wrong occasionally. You can simply make a very low offer and see how the seller responds. One downside to this, if the property is listed, is that some brokers will refuse to present your offer or will present it in such a way that you don't even get a counteroffer. If another buyer is in the wings, the low offer may give them the contrast they need to get their higher offer accepted. An alternative is learning to place a value on the property yourself. This is easier in a stable market, but possible in any market. I teach students in my seminars to estimate a price that is within 10%, plus or minus, of the value. I recently bought a house that was worth about $145,000. My estimation of the value was a range of $125,000 to $150,000. An appraisal would have been in that range. My first offer was $110,000, a little under 10% below my lower figure. And we closed at $115,000 with favorable owner financing. An important part of the value of this deal was the owner financing, which allowed me to buy with a small down payment and have several hundred dollars a month in cash flow. I would not have paid $115,000 cash for the house. See Normal Returns on Investment, ROI, on the next page. Part of the answer to the question, how much to pay, depends on the direction of the market in your town. Your paper may report that prices are going up or down, but every town has many markets. Every street has a market. Some streets have many foreclosures or short sales, while others have none. Different neighborhoods are different markets. While some streets have a lot of houses for sale or rent, others in the same price range may have none. Which streets have the more stable prices? Another factor, rarely considered by appraisers or prognosticators, that influences value is the number of free and clear properties in a neighborhood. Find a street that is loaded with long-term residents and you will find many free and clear and high equity properties. In addition to more stable prices, you will find more owner financing opportunities on these streets. Obviously, a street loaded with free and clear properties will have few, if any, foreclosures, although a long-term owner in a hurry occasionally needs to discount the price to attract a buyer. This lack of distressed sales helps keep the prices up in these neighborhoods. When credit is tight for potential home buyers, many people who would like to buy a house can't qualify for a loan. As credit becomes more available, more buyers will return to the market to compete for the existing housing inventory. The National Association of Realtors reports the amount of inventory and the average time on the market in different markets. Get this information for your town from a local realtor or look on the National Association of Realtors website, www.realtor.org. Short sales and foreclosures are all distressed sales. A distressed sale, a foreclosure or short sale, is not sold at a market price. Often the house being sold is not in good condition. It may need significant repairs just to make it livable. When a street has only distressed sales, then the perception is that all houses have dropped in value. When the distressed inventory is gone, the prices of houses in good condition will return to normal. What is normal? In a normal market, a buyer can choose from existing houses in good repair or new inventory. The new inventory sells for the builder's cost plus his profit, and buyers are willing to pay a premium for a new house that is available immediately. A comparable used house will sell for less. However, a well-maintained used home may be in a better location, and that location may command a premium. Normal Returns on Investment, ROI. In a normal market, a buyer of an investment house might expect a net return from rents in the 4 to 6% range. In a distressed market, houses sell for less, and the net return from rentals is higher. In a distressed market, you might make 8 to 12% net return based on distressed prices. This is higher than normal, and is only possible because of the bargain prices, not high rents. The rental market is often less volatile than the sales market. Rents will drop in a recession, but not as much as prices in hard-hit markets. Know the trends in the job market and the rental market in your town. When jobs and tenants are disappearing, you might make your best deals, but it is a risky time to buy. When the job and rental market show signs of improvement, you may have missed the bottom of the market, but there will still be plenty of good deals. It's much safer to buy when you know that you can find a good tenant than when you are uncertain about your ability to rent. You don't want to lower your standards and rent to a marginal tenant. In a soft market, drop your rents to attract, or maybe steal, a good tenant. Three ways to evaluate a house before you make an offer. Fair market value is the price that a willing buyer will pay a willing seller in an arm's-length transaction. Of course, the credit market has a lot to do with how much a buyer will pay. When the credit is freely available, prices will be higher than in a tight credit market. Market sales. Current sales are the primary source of comps or comparable sales used by appraisers to establish value in a residential appraisal in a normal market. If the market is heavily loaded with distressed sales, then you actually have two markets. There is a market for distressed sales and another for sales of non-distressed, in good condition both physically and financially, houses. In a typical market, a distressed sale would not be considered as a comparable for a well-maintained house sold in an arm's-length transaction. During a recession, distressed sales can be the majority of the sales, making it difficult for an appraiser to establish values. Bruce Norris, a successful California investor, overcomes this when selling by hiring an appraiser to research and find a number of comparable sales of rehabbed or other houses in good condition. They then share these comparable sales with the lender's appraiser. This helps the lender's appraiser and helps the buyer and the seller close the transaction. When determining what to offer, look for the trend in a neighborhood. When looking for trends in neighborhood house prices, the challenge is finding houses that are equal. Every house has a unique lot, design, features, neighbors, and has been cared for differently. The best way I know to compare values in a neighborhood is to compare sales of the same house, accounting for renovations, if any, and changes in the neighborhood. Look for sales 10 to 20 years apart to lap a market cycle. This takes local knowledge, and appraisers do not have the time to make this level of comparison. Appraisers have to produce an appraisal report in a few hours, so they rely heavily on sales figures from the public records. Although they try to find comparable properties, they can't take the time to drive every street and research every property to see if it is indeed a lot like the house that they are trying to appraise. Look for signs of improving streets. Look for streets where others are fixing up houses to rent or to sell. The average sale price will climb dramatically on these streets in a short time. Should you acquire a distressed property, the next step is to fix it up. I have purchased and renovated a number of houses. Here are some typical numbers. Purchase price $100,000. Repairs $40,000. Sale price $180,000. You can see the effect on the neighborhood and on comparable sales when a distressed property is turned into a retail property. Notice over or underimproved houses on the street. In a hot market, some builders and rehabbers build or remodel houses and make them too expensive for the neighborhood. They buy cheaper lots and build houses that are too big or too fancy for the market. These over-improved houses often sell for less than what it costs to build them. This will depress prices of the over-improved properties on these streets. Other streets have smaller, typically older houses built on good lots. These houses are likely to be expanded or simply raised as the lot value becomes more than the value of the improvements. Pay attention to the financial state of the owners. Are there a lot of realtor signs advertising short sales, or just a lot of signs? Short sales and foreclosures are an indication of the amount of debt, too much, on the properties. These properties will sell below the market, depressing the process for a while. If you are buying on a street with many foreclosures or short sales, calculate your best offer and then reduce it by another 20%. Look for long-term residents. One fun part about walking through neighborhoods and talking to the owners is finding someone who has lived in the same house for 50 years and knows the history and all about the current residents. They notice owners coming and going, know who has a growing family, and know who is close to moving out. A lot of long-term residents speaks well of a neighborhood. Neighborhoods can go downhill even with long-term owners, but I prefer to own in a neighborhood where people want to stay, not in one where they want to get out. Talking to people will give you the inside track on what is happening on a street. The income approach. Another approach used to establish a property's value is the income approach. Although with residential real estate, this approach is typically given less weight, but it can help you establish what to pay for a house. Houses are unique among income-producing real estate. Some property has only an investment value. The only reason you would buy a commercial or industrial building is to generate an income, so their value is primarily based on the income that they produce. A lower income results in a lower value. A house has value separate from its income. A house is valuable to a user, and often this value is higher than the value it has as a producer of income. In a normal market, a median-priced house will rent for enough to give an investor a 4 to 6% return. This is the return after expenses but before income taxes. This also disregards the effect of leverage. When you finance part of your purchase, your rate of return will be amplified. In order to compare apples with apples, compare incomes as if the houses were free and clear. When you can buy a house that will give you a much higher return than 4 to 6%, you have reinforcement that you are buying at a bargain price. Of course, less expensive houses often produce more gross cash flow, but they may also attract higher maintenance tenants, which leads to higher maintenance costs. Be careful to compare houses in the same general price range when comparing net incomes. The reproduction cost approach. A third way to determine value is to calculate what it would cost to reproduce a property. Of course, a reproduced house would be a new one, so an adjustment for the age and condition of the house would be used to adjust the value. In the price range that most of us buy houses for investment, the cost of construction would be in a fairly tight range. Different construction materials, block or brick instead of frame, might have an impact on both cost and marketability. Some builders have good reputations for building a quality house, while others build as cheaply as possible. These factors affect the long-term maintenance cost of a house and its value today. The part of the cost that is less consistent is the cost of not just the land, but also the site preparation. If a lot is low, it may require tens of thousands of dollars in fill, compacting, and grading before you can build. Likewise, if drainage is an issue, you can spend an extraordinary amount installing a septic system. Additionally, if you don't have access to a central water system, a well can be a big expense. These items can be expensive, but add little value to the house, since every house needs working plumbing and a building pad. Landscaping is not a big factor when buying a rental, but it can be expensive. Don't put a lot of value on landscaping and site improvements. Using the three approaches to determine how much to offer. In a rising market, the market approach has advantages over the income and reproduction approaches. Rents sometimes lag behind price increases, so the income approach can be low. And move-in ready houses with mature landscaping in an established neighborhood will sell for a premium over a house to be built, so your existing houses may be worth more than reproduction costs. In a falling market, the income approach is a good gauge. If you can buy a house and get an 8 to 10% return on your money when banks are paying a fraction of that on savings accounts, it's a good deal. Combine that with the opportunity to buy with a low interest rate loan, and you have a license to steal. Your perception of the future will influence your offer. Because your perception of your market will influence how much you offer, the seller's perception of the future will influence how he responds to your offer. Find a seller who thinks the market is still going down, and your chances of making a good deal go up. The public is always a day late when it comes to recognizing the top or bottom of a market. Chapter 6. Knowing how you are going to pay for a house before you buy. Before you make an offer to buy a house, you need to have a plan to pay for it. Your tenants can repay the money that you borrow if you pay a bargain price and borrow on better than market terms. The first step to making a profitable deal is to figure out how much income your tenants will generate. You do not set the rent on a house. The market sets the rent. Some landlords try to rent their property for an amount equal to their loan payments. The tenants don't care how much your loan payments are. They will pay the least amount of rent they can for the best house they decide they can afford. Tenants will compare the houses on the market and rent the one that is the best deal. To determine how much rent you can expect to collect, you need to study your market. Good information is available because landlords advertise their houses online and in your newspaper every week. How much can your potential tenants afford to pay? To determine the amount of rent you can collect, conduct a rent survey of your competing landlords. Identify your target neighborhoods and your price range for desired rent. Check rents on online sites that list rentals in your town, like Craigslist, and look for rental ads in your local paper. Then look for houses advertised for rent in your price ranges and, if possible, in your target neighborhoods. Once you've found a few listings, call the landlord and ask the questions any potential renter would ask, noting his or her answers. 1. Have you rented the house? 2. How big are the house and yard? 3. Has the house been updated? 4. What appliances come with the house? 5. Is the yard fenced? 6. Is it on a busy street? 7. How much is the rent? 8. Will you accept kids and pets? 9. Is there a limit to how many people can live in the house? 10. How much is the security deposit? 11. How long must the lease be? 12. How long has the house been empty? You cannot assume that all of the answers are true, but a smart landlord will be truthful. The answers are easy to check by looking at the house. You want to sort through the responses and separate the smart landlords, those who are charging a reasonable rent and security deposit, from the others, those who are willing to rent to anyone. A landlord who has low standards for tenants or who will rent to too many people, such as 6 college students, can charge more than market rate. After the bad tenant moves out and the landlord makes repairs to the house, he will net far less rent. Likewise, some landlords will rent without requiring a last month's rent or reasonable security deposit. They, too, can charge above market rent because they will let a tenant who has little money move in. These tenants often fall behind on their rent immediately because they don't have any money. Surprisingly, many landlords will not answer the phone or respond to an inquiry when they are paying a lot of money to support an empty house. Prepare a chart like Table 6.1 found in the accompanying PDF and record the information you obtain when talking to the landlords. Next, go see the houses that have rented and the houses that are still for rent. Make notes about the neighborhood and the condition of the houses and start learning about your competition. Many landlords do not buy good properties, nor do they maintain the houses well. Try to buy in better neighborhoods and keep your houses in good condition. This will reduce your vacancies because your houses will be the first to rent. Now that you have a good idea of what your competition is and have studied the amount of rents, deposits, and number of vacancies in your target neighborhood, you can make a good estimate of the amount of rent you can expect to collect. Rents and prices go up, but at different times. One big benefit of investing in houses is that your rents will increase significantly over the years, whereas your loan payments can remain the same until the loan is paid off. Rents tend to increase at the same rate as prices, but in different years. In a hot real estate market, when prices are increasing rapidly, rents may be stable and may even drop. This is a result of low interest rates, which allow renters to buy houses and encourage builders to build. When interest rates are low and house prices are rising rapidly, many investors also buy houses and rent them. This increased supply of rental houses, coupled with many renters becoming homeowners, can keep rents low. When interest rates rise, fewer renters can qualify to buy and fewer investors buy houses for rental. These factors combine to cause a tight rental market and rents rise as tenants compete for fewer houses. Understanding and recognizing these cycles in your town is important. Although rents will increase in the long run, these cycles often last several years at a time. See Figure 6.1 in the accompanying PDF. Notice that house prices increase in some years, are flat in others, and even occasionally drop. Although, when they drop, they rarely drop below the earlier low, and when they recover, they often surpass the previous high. This result is more pronounced in markets prone to big swings in prices. In a market where house prices just creep up every year, it will appear that rents and prices go up together. Although rents and prices can experience short-term dips, in the long run, both will increase with inflation. These dips will be larger in higher-priced properties. How much will you spend to operate the house? Every house will cost a different amount to operate. Well-designed and well-built homes that have been maintained and are well-situated on good lots will be far less expensive to maintain than poorly designed and built homes on troublesome lots. You want to buy a house that will produce the most income in relation to what it will cost to operate. You might think that a very small house that would be less expensive to maintain would be best. But you want a house that is large enough to attract a good long-term tenant.